Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now with today's topic, here is James White.
And good morning. Welcome to a jumbo dividing line today. Yes, Ralph, just a jumbo one. Sorry. I always hate to be the cause of disappointment for you, but we'll be going 90 minutes today on the program, continuing our examination of the comments of Dia Mohammed and Bart Ehrman. Two very different levels there, I might note. I'm actually going to bring up some of the cross-examination questions I asked of Dr. Ehrman to sort of illustrate the level of perfectionism that is a part of his perspective. But before we get to all of that, I wanted to comment on some things that William Lane Craig has said. But before even then, I have a travel tip for you. Yes, beginning the program with a travel tip. How unusual could that be? Well, why would I give you a travel tip? Well, I left a book in the seat back pocket of my flight to St. Louis this weekend. I was sitting at lunch Saturday with some of the brothers from the church, and my phone starts going off. And I looked at the number. I didn't recognize the number. Almost didn't answer it, especially while traveling, but I decided to anyways. And it was U.S. Airways. And they were saying, did you leave? And it was my copy of the new book edited by Daniel Wallace on revisiting the textual corruption in the New Testament. Some great stuff in there. And they're calling me saying, did I leave that on the plane? I hadn't even realized I had, to be perfectly honest with you. I have two paper copies of the book. And I'm like, how did they know? And then I realized, here's the travel tip. Always put your boarding pass in your book as your bookmark. Because then when it's found, they'll know whose book it was, and then they'll be able to look at the flight manifest and return it to you. Now, it may have helped that I was in first class. I am a frequent flyer. I'm almost, if I had one more decent trip this year, I would have rated platinum. Yes, folks, I am now watching that movie. What was the movie called where Tom Hanks lived in the airport? What was that called? I've forgotten what that one was called. Terminal. That's right. That's almost where I have been this year. And so I was up in first class. But I have discovered that if you want to meet famous people, sit in first class 2A. 2A. Now, why do I say that? Because sometime earlier this year, I was sitting in 2A and ended up sitting next to America's Sheriff, Joe Arpaio. I forget where we were going. I think it was in Texas, maybe, somewhere. I don't remember. Houston? Was it Houston? Okay. I was going to Houston, and all the way there, I was chatting with Joe Arpaio. Well, this time I was in 1F, so I'm in the... I don't really like 1 a whole lot because you can't put your bag there and you got to put it all up, so you got to get down there first and get your stuff up there and blah, blah, blah. So I was over in 1F, and the guy sits in 1D right next to me. Is telling the flight attendant, you know, our reservations were messed up, and I had to buy a ticket for my wife this morning, and you know how expensive that was on a same-day flight, and she's back there, and I'm noticing that there's a seat open in first, and would you mind if nope, that person doesn't show up, if brought my wife forward? And I said to the flight attendant, I'll tell you what, I'll move over to that empty seat and let them sit together if that's what happens. And they said, thank you very much. And so the door closed. Whoever was supposed to be in 2A didn't make it. So I said, I'm moving over. And they brought her up and put her in 1F. And as I'm getting up, I look over, and the guy in the aisle, so in 2C, because it's A, C, and DF, he's a black fellow, and he's reading a Bible. And so I'm like, fellow believer, maybe. We'll find out. I'll introduce myself, you know. So he gets up, lets me sit down, and he closes his Bible as he gets up, you know, to, you know, he's not going to hold on to it hanging, you know. And when he sits down, he puts it in his lap, and I've introduced myself, and I just happen to look down, and I look at the name on the Bible, and the name is Meadowlark Lemon. Meadowlark Lemon, yes, the Meadowlark Lemon of the Harlem Globetrotters fame. And it was funny. All the way to St. Louis now. I'm talking with Meadowlark Lemon, and I'm doing most of the talking. Now, he did tell some interesting stories about, Nikita Khrushchev jumping out of a limousine and bear hugging him and, stuff like that. I mean, one of the first quotes he gave me was from Sammy Davis Jr. He says, Sammy Davis Jr. told me once, he says, as soon as you leave your home, you're on stage. Always remember that. And, you know, he and I walked together to the baggage claim, and I couldn't believe the number of people that were stopping. No, he's not that tall. He is not that tall. I wouldn't put him past 6'1", 6'2". I really wouldn't. But, of course, he's also 80 years old, so he's probably not as tall as he once was. Anyway, I did most of the talking because when I told him what I did, he starts at, he asked some questions about Islam, and I was narrating all sorts of stuff, and then he said, now I shouldn't say this. Well, they're not going to hear this. they're not listening to this. He said, now he says, I know I'm getting an iPad for Christmas. My family doesn't know I'm getting an iPad for Christmas. My family's getting me an iPad for Christmas. They don't know that I know that I'm getting an iPad for Christmas. And so I said, well, let me show you the best Bible software. So I'm illustrating how Olive Tree works, and showing him how I use it for sermons and stuff like this. And the interesting thing is, he lives in Scottsdale, and he really, really wants to take my apologetics class in January, when I teach it for Golden Gate. So that would be really, really cool. So we had a great time. My son just tweeted, now we both know a Harlem Globetrotter. Curly Boo Johnson is a member at the Village. So I guess my son knows one.
And
yes, sir?
And did you point out to Mr.
Did you realize you have to look at the talking to them on the side?
Yeah. Okay. Did you realize?
There you go.
Okay. Did you realize and point out to Mr. Lemon what a great metaphor the Globetrotters was to the spiritual reality of Scripture, that the outcome has already been determined.
No, I did. I actually that slipped my mind, Barry. I'm not sure how it slipped my mind, but many of the things you say slipped my mind too. So I'm not sure how that works. Anyhow, it was really cool. And our travel tip for the day is always put your boarding pass in your book if you're going to put it into the seat back in case you forget, because that's why I forgot it there, is because I put it up there, and I even said to myself, man, put it in your bag, or you're going to forget it. And then I looked over, and Meadowlark was reading from Isaiah, and I said, can I show you something? And I showed him the citation of Isaiah 8:13 in 1 Peter 3:15. And I'm showing him the Greek and stuff like that, and he's going, man, I got to learn this stuff. He says, when I became a Christian back in the 80s, I asked somebody, and I said, should I go to Bible college? And they said, it's too late for you. So I had asked him how old you are, and he just looked at me and smiled and says, I'm ageless. So when I got in Chandler, everybody jumped on Wikipedia and said, hey, he's 80. Okay. Man, he did not look 80. He did not look 80 years old at all. Even though he said his right knee is a mess. He still gets out on the court and does his thing and spins the ball and does all that kind of stuff. So I thought that was really, really interesting. Anyhow, that travel tip aside, while I was in St. Louis, the folks over at TriBlog just linked to a statement by William Lane Craig, and I asked Deo Valente and Channel, who posts on TriBlog, hey, what's the reference at? Because the reference hadn't been given. And this is actually one of William Lane Craig's this is from his Reasonable Faith, question number 239, Molinism and the Soteriological Problem of Evil once more. And there is very interesting. There's a lot of stuff here that we could address. But let me just read the last two paragraphs. On a related note, I have a hard time believing that there are any human beings who would freely reject the gospel under any and all circumstances. Anybody who knows of Jehovah's existence, his love, his plan for salvation, and rejects it all in favor of eternal torment is literally insane. No sane human being chooses eternal flames over eternal bliss. Your view seems to require, because he's responding to somebody, that such sane people not only exist but are plentiful. That seems to me empirically wrong. I also suspect that there are no human beings who would accept the gospel in any and all circumstances, but that is a different matter. Finally, even if we grant that Fred would have rejected the gospel in any and all circumstances, why did God just not bother creating him? After all, these are the questions, actually, this is the questions being asked here. This is the final two questions. I need to actually go below that. I apologize to his response. Here we go. Here's the response. How do you know that God couldn't put together a world? This is Craig's response to the Fred stuff I was just talking about. How do you know that God couldn't put together a world in which the unreached are people who wouldn't bend the knee under any circumstances? Now, let's start catching some of this language. God couldn't put together a world. The normal terminology that Molinists use here is actuate. But let's remember what the Molinist is saying here. God is faced with counterfactuals. He is faced, because of his middle knowledge, with this ability to look at all possible worlds. But the content of all possible worlds is determined by his middle knowledge of what people would and would not do given certain circumstances. This has not come from his sovereign decree. It comes from somewhere else. I don't know where else. It comes from somewhere. I don't know where. And so when he talks about couldn't put together, same thing as couldn't actuate, this is this Molinist view of God running through all these possible permutations. When you think about the free actions of all these billions and billions of people over thousands and thousands of years, and given that Craig seems to be a theistic evolutionist, millions and millions of years, when you put it all together, he has to be a real big computer, almost like IBM Blue or something. I don't know. So we continue on. In fact, this hypothesis has real implications for other issues like the wider problem of evil. For example, maybe only in a world involving scads of natural and moral evil could God arrange the sort of world we're envisioning. Maybe his desire to achieve an optimal balance between saved and lost overrides the benefits of a world with less natural and moral evil. It may well be that getting the right counterfactuals of creaturely freedom in place to achieve number three involves putting up with a lot of otherwise gratuitous evil. So, you've got, here's God, and God's ultimate goal is the optimal balance between saved and lost. There's God's goal. God's goal, well, you got to forget all that Westminster stuff about, the glory of God and stuff like that. That's way too God-centered. We need to have something much more man-centered here. And so God's goal is to come up with this balance, this optimal balance between saved and lost. And so he's running all of these possibilities, and he comes up with the best world, with the best optimal balance between saved and lost. But to get that involves putting up with a lot of otherwise gratuitous evil. But hey, it's the best he can do. Why? Because, well, it's going to be explained here. In an amazing analogy, he says, your claim that there are an infinite number of beings God can create who would freely accept the gospel without somebody else rejecting it is guilty of the same error you alleged earlier, namely speaking without a context. Suppose that for any possible person, there may be circumstances under which he would be freely saved without someone's being lost. It doesn't follow that there is a feasible world in which every person would be freely saved without someone's being lost. For the relevant circumstances may not become possible. Your pun on Sophie's Choice, a choice between two bad options, reveals that you haven't yet grasped the theory of middle knowledge. Here, folks, here it is. What does it take? What will you come to understand if you grasp the theory of middle knowledge? Here it is. For God doesn't create such a choice for himself. The counterfactuals of creaturely freedom which confront him are outside his control. He has to play with the hand he has been dealt. There you go. Did you see that? Listen to what it says. It reveals you haven't yet grasped the theory of middle knowledge, for God doesn't create such a choice for himself. The counterfactuals of creaturely freedom, which confront him, are outside his control. He has to play with the hand he has been dealt. So there's the Molinist God, and he's doing the best he can. I mean, come on, he really, really, really has, he's working hard. He really is. And so, it's the hand. It's the hand he's been dealt. That's the best he can do. Now, I don't know about you, but that's absolutely offensive to me. That is absolutely offensive. First of all, clearly what I really appreciate about these two sentences is that they summarize what I've been saying, and that they summarize, in fact, what I said about this issue when I spoke over at the Reformed Baptist Church right off campus of Biola. And that is one of the chief problems, one of the things that honestly ends up creating, I think, just fundamental theistic problems in Molinism, is you have this idea that there is something that exists that can actually determine God's actions, but it's outside of his control and outside of his creative decree. So where did it come from? These counterfactuals have reality. They really exist so much so that they can determine how God can act. And notice the terminology uses. The counterfactuals of creaturely freedom, which confront him. Confront him from whence, Dr. Craig? From whence does this confronting come? That sounds like it's outside of him. It's not a part of his... The whole point of middle knowledge is this is not a part of his decree. Because it comes before the decree. It's between that free knowledge and natural knowledge, and that's why it's middle knowledge, that's what the name means, and it comes before the decree. And in fact, in this perspective, determines the nature of the decree. So you have this external stuff, the counterfactuals of creaturely freedom, which can determine what God can do. Look, they're outside his control. He's just got to play with the hand he has been dealt. There's the Molinist God. I don't worship that God. I'll be perfectly honest with you. I do not worship that God. That's a strange deity to me. I don't find him in the Bible. I don't find any basis for believing that in the Bible. And honestly, folks, all it is a humanly derived, philosophically grounded means of trying to continue to enshrine and enthrone the idol of the sovereignty of man. That's all it is. And I just, the more I read it and the more I hear people just falling over themselves these days, including people who call themselves Reformed, to utilize this kind of language, I just, it makes me ill. Just, it literally makes me ill. I don't understand the desire for it, but there it is. There it is. So, there you've got William Lane Craig's amazing statements on theology. All right, let's get back to our series that we've been doing. And this will give me about 35 minutes for each one. I want to play some portions before we get back to the Wallace Ehrman debate. I want to fully illustrate the fact that the standard that Bart Ehrman is setting for being able to say we can trust the New Testament is an irrational one. And evidently, previous generations would have, I think, more openly proclaimed Ehrman to be completely off balance here. But for some reason, the majority of modern-day scholarship lacks the intestinal fortitude to say that today. I'll just be perfectly honest with you. I think that there should be more people saying what is obvious, and that is anybody who claims to be a historian and who claims to be dealing with works of antiquity, who makes the standard absolute perfection and possession of the originals for there to be any trustworthiness in the text, is just not even in anywhere near the ballpark as to how human beings have dealt with this issue all along. And maybe he's just fine and says, I don't care. I don't care what anybody else. I am me, and I get to define these things. I don't know. But there's more people that just need to come out and say, this is ridiculous. What you're telling us? Remember the example that I played at the beginning of the last program. If we found 10 copies of Mark written within 10 days of the original that are 99.991% identical to one another, that would be good enough. And, of course, there is no work of antiquity that comes within, literally, I mean, even, let's leave the New Testament aside, any other work of antiquity that comes to within 1/50,000th of that standard. So if your standard is such that basically everybody who's come before you was a bunch of idiots for even bothering, why in the world are we? And yet at the same time, the man will say, the 1% textual variance, the originals and all those, it's what came before, we don't know. It's such a moving target that it's pretty rare that he actually gets pinned down. And so I wanted to play some of the cross-examination that I did with him to further illustrate this before we dive back into his opening presentation. I think it will shed more light on the topic and hopefully be useful to us in the process. So here is a section of my cross-examination of Bart Ehrman. This is from 2009.
Since you disagree with evidently Kurt Aland on the issue of tenacity, could you list for us some variations in the New Testament where you are willing to assert that none of the extant readings in the manuscript tradition could possibly be the original?
Now, reasoning behind the question, I had raised the issue of the tenacity of the text, and one of Ehrman's responses was to seek to talk about Kurt. His more than once, his whole argument was, well, I sip lattes with these guys. You just got to understand. And, just very much believing his own press on everything, which, I think turned the audience off. And certainly I ignored it at the time in listening to the debate afterwards. I am amazed at the number of slights and the behavior that Dr. Ehrman exhibited. But be that as it may, the question is, if you don't believe in the tenacity of the text, in other words, if you believe that original readings can disappear, then could you suggest to us, please, some places where the original reading in a variant is no longer in the manuscripts? Now, I was expecting, there are some tough textual variants. There are some textual variants of 4 or 5 different options, and there aren't that many of them, but there are enough of them to just give you a headache to try to figure out some of these variants. And so I was expecting some of those, but what we got wasn't even close. Listen to what he says.
No, I think there's always a possibility. It's not a question of possibility, it's a question of probability. Of course, anything could possibly have been original. The original author might have written nonsense. And why not? It's possible. And later scribes might have corrected that nonsense. So one has to weigh probability. It's interesting that Westcott and Hort, the two giants in this field in the 19th century, were quite insistent that most of the text of the New Testament.
Now let me just stop there for just a moment. Let's think for a second about what he said about possibilities. He said it's a possibility that the original writings may have just contained absolute nonsense, and then somebody else came along and fixed it. Let's think about that for just a second. If that was the case, and if the originals were copied more than once, would each individual who made the copies fix things differently, given that the original was nonsense? Well, of course they would. No one could. If I gave you a nonsense text, and we gave 10 people 10 paragraphs of nonsense and said, fix it, would they all fix it in the same way? No, they'd all, since it's nonsense, you have to just come up with something. So every single one would be different. Every single emendation and fixing would be different, which would mean that we would have 20, 30, 40 different kinds of the Gospel of Mark, none of which were even slightly related to the other. And Dr. Ehrman knows that's not what the manuscript evidence shows. And so there isn't any possibility of that. That is an absurdity to even suggest it. I mean, that's on the level of saying, well, who knows, space aliens could have beamed down from the Enterprise and given us the New Testament. That kind of argumentation doesn't advance the field any, does it? It doesn't.
It was preserved in a codex like Codex Vaticanus, and yet they resorted to conjectural emendation on a large number of occasions. If you want an example, if you want just one example, I mean, I don't know how much sense it'll make in English, but one common one that my teacher, Bruce Metzger, used to talk about as being possibly a strong case for emendation is 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 19. Which follows a creedal statement about Christ. The Greek text, well, I guess I better read it in English, says, Christ suffered for sins once and for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, in order that he might lead you, textual variant there, to God, having been put to death in the flesh, but having been made alive in the spirit. And then chapter 19, then the verse, next verse says, En ho kai tois en phulake pneumasi parutheis ekheruksen, in which also he preached, having gone forth, he preached to the spirits who were in prison. Boyer and others, including Harris, have proposed emendations at this point because, for grammatical reasons, but also because they think that, in fact, it might be a mistake, that, in fact, this is talking about the old early Christian tradition about Enoch, who was preaching the preaching of Enoch, according to some of the apocryphal materials.
Now, let me stop right there. I was amazed at this, and I only get more amazed the more I review these things. Here we have the go-to guy for the corruption of the New Testament, and I hand him a blank slate Could you give us a list? Could you suggest some places where we don't have the original in any manuscript at all? And you know what one verse he gives us? A verse, 1 Peter 3:19, where there are no textual variants. There's no textual variant here. There is not a single manuscript that even shows an interruption of the text at all. And even then, he's right, Boyer, Harris, conjecture. But he said, notice he invoked the hallowed name of Bruce Metzger, my teacher. May I quote from his teacher's textual commentary? Several scholars, notice he did not say himself, several scholars have advocated the conjectural emendation that introduces the subject Enoch. Instead of improving the intelligibility of the passage, as a conjectured reading ought to do, the word Enoch breaks the continuity of the argument by introducing an abrupt and unexpected change of subject from that of verse 18. So Metzger's published work does not substantiate and does not support the idea of the conjectural emendation. So evidently, here I've given him the opportunity. Evidently, what he's saying is in all the rest of the textual variants in the New Testament, whether there's only two readings, whether there's three readings, five readings, or 10 readings, he admits one of them is the original. But only in a place where, well, maybe it said Enoch. Maybe we can conjecture this. But what's so odd is that even, you know, Kurt and Barbara Olland very clearly indicated that whenever there is a disruption in the manuscript, in the transmission of the text, it will be represented by variation in the manuscript tradition. Obviously, Ehrman disagrees. Obviously, Ehrman rejects that. But people who've done a whole lot more work than Ehrman, this is what you need to understand, folks. Bart Ehrman is not involved in doing frontline textual work any longer. He was for about, what, 10, 15 years at the most? The Ollins did it their entire lives. They didn't abandon that and go off and start writing books to make lots of money, like misquoting Jesus or Jesus Interrupted or Forged or stuff like that. They didn't show up on the Colbert Report. They actually did this their entire lives for decades on end. So you gotta understand why people take the positions they do and not be influenced. In fact, it's interesting, during the debate, we're going to hear him upbraiding Dan Wallace, saying, nobody talks about the originals anymore. No one. They've given up on all that. And then when he defines the time frame of that, the last 20 years, sort of connecting that with his own work, obviously. I have done this. And, yeah, there's times when, you know, there was imbalance during the days of Tischendorf because of the finding of Sinaiticus. Well, we recovered that. You know what? I hope I live long enough to see us recover balance in New Testament textual criticism after the age of Ehrman. We're about the same age, though, so I sort of doubt it. But my kids hopefully will. So I found that fascinating.
So, I mean, it strikes me that that's a plausible place where you might need an emendation. So, what percentage do you believe of the New Testament is impacted by viable meaning textual variants?
Now, I think that is an absolutely valid question to ask. Honestly, if you're going to say we can't trust the text of the New Testament, then shouldn't you be able to ask one of these leading scholars, well, you know, can you put a percentage on it? I'm not asking for something. It's funny. He's willing to demand 99.991% textual purity in his debate with Wallace in answer to an audience question. Now I'll take a 10% one way or the other. It's a perfectly valid question. He didn't seem to like it.
I've never put a percentage on something like that because I'm not sure that percentage actually means anything. I mean, for example, if I speak a sentence in 100 words and I change only one of the words, but the word that I change is whether I say the word not or not, the entire sentence is reversed in meaning. Well, it'd only be a 1% change, but it'd be really important. So I don't think percentages. I've never really tried to calculate percentages because I don't think they matter.
You have often said that there are verses where variants change the meaning of an entire book. Could you give us some examples?
A verse of changing an entire book. Yeah, sure. I think that I actually do think that if.
Now, background information. I knew where he was going to go. I've listened to the man's classes. I've listened to his debates. He didn't listen to anything I've ever done because he doesn't feel that I have anything meaningful to add to the subject. And the night before, I had encountered him in the bar at the hotel, which was just this little thing in the lobby, basically, that had TVs in it. And he was watching a basketball game, and I introduced myself. And I let him know that the next afternoon, during the conference, because this debate was a part of the conference, during the conference, I was going to do a presentation on Hebrews 2:9 and Mark 1:41 and his favorite examples of textual variants that change the entire meaning of a book. Do you think he showed up to hear what I had to say? Nah, he was in the gym. He doesn't care what I have to say. Doesn't care what anybody has to say. He really does think that he is the torchbearer. He's the man. And he doesn't need to hear what anybody else has to say. That's resulted in some fascinating issues when he does attend various conferences and stuff like that. But I knew where he was going to go.
Hebrews 2:9 said that Jesus died apart from God, that there is no place in Hebrews then where Jesus is said to have died by the grace of God. And that the meaning now, I think, for Hebrews means that Jesus died like a full flesh and blood human being without any divine comfort or support.
Now, let's understand what he's arguing here, okay? I mean, and this is important. I may not even get back to the Wallace one. I may not even get done with this one here. That's fine. If that's no reason to hurry. Hebrews 2:9. The variant is very small. It is the difference between chorus theou and kadati theou. And the reading that is found in almost all Bibles is by that he might, by God's grace, taste death in behalf of all. And chorus theou, which is found only in manuscript 0243, 1739. 1739 is an important minuscule that's a copy of a 3rd century manuscript. It's in the margin of a few Vulgate manuscripts, and Origen mentions that he has seen this reading. Ehrman claims that Origen said it was the majority. I checked that citation. Origen didn't say that, which I will mention in my questioning at this point. You'll hear that in a moment. Anyway, it is fascinating to listen to this man who is, he so often brings theology in without doing it openly. But then when you challenge him on the theology, he defaults back to naturalistic historian. You can't challenge me on theology. I'm a historian. I'm just saying historical stuff. Well, he's not just saying historical stuff. Right now, he's pretending to interpret the text for us. And the reality is, I don't think there is any place in all the New Testament that says Jesus died by the grace of God. Now, the concept, duh. The concept's all through the New Testament. And it's... I've been preaching through Hebrews now for years. And the death of Christ as the expression of God's grace, mercy, and purpose is absolutely central to the epistle. But what I had asked was, could you show us a place where the variant changes the meaning of the book? Are you supposed to tell me, are you really seriously telling me that, well, he died without God means that he died as a human being without any divine succor or assistance? That this subclause at the end of a sentence is the thesis statement for the book of Hebrews? So if you change this, you're changing the entire purpose of the book of Hebrews. Let's say we go with the vast majority of manuscripts that says that by the grace of God, he might taste death in behalf of all. How does that fit with the book of Hebrews? Well, it is talking about his death, and this is where he talks about the brethren and who he dies for and all the rest of that stuff. And it fits perfectly with his being the intermediator and all the rest of that stuff. All right, let's say it says chorus to you, that he died as a true man and that God did not intervene to stop it. Does that change anything in Hebrews? No, it doesn't change a single thing. Well, it'd be the only place in Hebrews where it says he died by the grace of God. Where else in the Bible is that found? I mean, to make the demand that that particular phrase appears is as bad as when the Muslims say, well, there's no place where it specifically, Jesus specifically says, worship me as God. I am God, worship me, blah, 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 blah. It just does not make any sense. So that's why I asked the question. And notice the follow-up dialogue.
If the reading is not chorus theou, but charis theou, that he died by the grace of charity theou, he died by the grace of God, then, in fact, you do have the teaching that Jesus' death was an act of divine grace in Hebrews, which otherwise you don't have.
And yet, when you argued that point in the Orthodox Corruption of Scripture, did you not argue that chorus theou is consistent with the theology of Hebrews?
Yeah, the variant changes it.
So, he can determine the theology of Hebrews is consistent with chorus theou, but not charity theou. Do you want Bart Ehrman as an interpreter of Hebrews? What's his... I would like to... Could someone explain something to me? Why is it that a guy who did his dissertation in the development of the early Alexandrian text gets to be considered a theologian in the interpretation of Hebrews? Aren't those sort of two separate fields? Oh, but he went to Princeton. Seriously, folks, that's where a lot... Well, he went to Princeton. Well, there's lots of folks that are teaching at Princeton that can't tell that homosexuality is a sin in God's sight. So I don't know if that's really a good place to go, to be perfectly honest with you. I absolutely, positively amazed at that kind of argumentation. But see, the point is, he can know what the theology of Hebrews is apart from whatever Hebrews 2:9 says. He's arguing that there is a theology of Hebrews and it's consistent with chorus. But is he really trying to say that if it says charity, all the rest of all that Hebrews says is overthrown? Seriously? I don't think he even begins to try to substantiate that.
How can you argue that it's consistent with the theology of Hebrews if...
I'm not saying chorus. I'm saying that charis, depending on which variant you have, the meaning of the book changes.
So nowhere else in the book do you have this idea of Jesus' death that would be presented in Hebrews 2:9 based upon reading one 10th century manuscript and Origen's manuscripts, at least some of Origen's manuscripts. You said the majority, but I don't know where Origen actually said that.
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
So your assertion then is that the book of Hebrews would not present that view of the atonement of Jesus unless you have that reading in Hebrews 2:9. Elsewhere, it just doesn't.
Nowhere else does Hebrews say that Jesus died by the grace of God. This is the one place.
I understand that, but you believe that the original is chorus because that is consistent with the writing of Hebrews, with
That's
the
right.
theology of Hebrews.
And the variant changes that.
Away from it. Okay, I understand what you're saying.
I understand what he's saying, but it makes absolutely no sense. And he didn't seem to, I moved on, because he didn't seem to get the inconsistency in A, being able to say, well, the rest of the book of Hebrews argues this theology. But this one text, if it says he died by the grace of God, then all the rest of that stuff's thrown out. All the rest of that stuff gets changed. It makes no sense. The emperor has no clothes, but evidently no one wants to stand up and say it, lest you not get an invitation to the next big academic thing or something. I don't get it.
On the Unbelievable radio program in London, you discussed the length of time that exists between the writing of Paul's letter to the Galatians and the first extant copy, that being 150 years. You described this time period as enormous. That's a quote. Could you tell us what term you would use to describe the time period between, say, the original writings of Suetonius or Tacitus or Pliny and their first extant manuscript copies?
Very enormous.
Sorry, ginormous would be a good one?
Ginormous.
Ginormous, okay.
Ginormous doesn't cover it. The New Testament, we have much earlier attestation than for any other book from antiquity. What you can't do is then say, well, then you can't trust any book from antiquity. Okay, yes, right. That's right.
So
now it sounds to me, I'm that could be taken two different ways. He says, what you can't do is then say you can't trust any book from antiquity. But then he says, but that's right. And so when a young lady asked him about reading some of the classics from that time period, in the debate with Dan Wallace, his response was, I'm sorry you wasted your time. Now, is that meant to be facetious? I don't know. But he just said the New Testament has the earliest attestation of any work of antiquity. He says in the Wallace debate has the widest attestation of any work of antiquity. So it's the earliest. It's the widest. But you see, it just doesn't matter because it's not a photocopy. The standard is of a work that does not exist. He cannot point us to any work of antiquity that meets his standard. None. That's why he's called a radical skeptic. And appropriately identified as a radical skeptic.
Oh,
that's right.
So it would be correct to write a book called Misquoting Suetonius?
Absolutely. Scholars do this.
And
scholars write.
Now, the funny thing is, you will never find in his books, when he quotes these people, him raising questions about the accuracy of the citation. That's what I was trying to bring up here, but he just didn't get it.
Write books all the time about how you don't know about what Plato actually wrote, or what Homer wrote, or Suetonius, or Tacitus, Euripides. This is just what scholars do. Of course, there are scads of books on just these topics.
And so when you cite them in your works, you will say, according to the best sources, and we'll question the reliability of Suetonius or Gospel of Thomas, whatever it might be.
There's no scholar who's an expert in Suetonius or Cicero or the Gospel of Thomas who would tell you that we absolutely know what these texts originally said.
Now, that's not what I asked him, was it? What I asked him is, when you cite these books in your books, when you cite them, you include your skepticism, right? I've never seen an example of it, at least not up to 2009. It's only the New Testament for some odd, strange reason.
So when you say know what these texts originally said, but they will believe that we have a sufficiently clear knowledge to quote Suetonius. You quote Suetonius, don't you?
Yes, of course. I quote the manuscript tradition of Suetonius. I mean, it's just understood among scholars what you're quoting.
And so you say in your books, I'm not really quoting Suetonius. I'm just this isn't really what he said.
I'm saying that we don't have the original text for any writing from the ancient world. The New Testament is no different. Just as you can't establish the original text of the New Testament because you don't have sufficient evidence, you can't establish the original text of Suetonius because you don't have original evidence. For some of these authors...
So there, you know, it almost sounds to me like he's a Trojan horse in the sense that I'm a textual critical scholar, but I'm here to tell you that my entire field of work is bananas. It's worthless. We can't do it. Even in the New Testament, despite having all these thousands of manuscripts and earliest edits, it just doesn't matter. We can't do it. We have to give up. Yeah, it almost sounds like what he's... And you know what? Given that he's been influential in diverting New Testament textual critical studies from the original text, giving up on that. Maybe that's exactly what it's all about. Maybe that's why he's there. I don't know.
The manuscript tradition is pathetic. I mean, for some very important works from antiquity, we have one manuscript that's a palimpsest. And so, yes, absolutely, we have exactly the same problem. And when you say that, nobody goes on about the Gospel of Thomas, absolutely wrong.
I, of course, did not say that no one goes on about the Gospel of Thomas. What I did was I said, whenever you quote the Gospel of Thomas, do you include the same skeptical conditions that you do when you talk about the New Testament? I'm well aware of the, in fact, had mentioned, if I recall correctly, in my presentation that he chose not to go to, and if not, I've certainly mentioned it many, many times, the pathetic textual grounding and history for the Gospel of Thomas. And in fact, there's an excellent article, in that new book edited by Dan Wallace that compares the Greek fragments with the Coptic version of the Gospel of Thomas. I mean, if anybody who thinks they know what Thomas said and would even dare to compare that level of textual data with, say, the Gospel of Mark is just not even in the ballpark. There is so little textual data for Thomas in comparison to any book in the New Testament. And I just didn't say that.
Scholars of the Gospel of Thomas talk about this all the time. I mean, this is a major issue of scholarship.
I'm sorry, I didn't say that they don't discuss such things, sir, but anyway. Peter Williams of Cambridge suggested that if you were to edit an edition...
Now, this is actually the question I was looking for. I decided to do the whole thing because it's illustrative of these issues. And I had forgotten that it was Peter Williams who had made this statement, but that's because he was dialoguing with him on the Unbelievable Radio program again. Listen to how quickly and easily Ehrman agrees with my question, but then when I make application, he seems to get completely lost. What I mean is, I ask him, would you agree that if you got to choose the textual variants, you got to create the Bart Ehrman Greek New Testament, where you choose all the textual variants. So it's going to say Chorus Theou at Hebrews 2:9, and Jesus is going to be angry in Mark 1:41, and stuff like that. Would you agree that your resultant text would disagree less from today's Nestle-Aland text than the TR does? And he goes, oh, sure. Then I ask him in application, then that means that your view of the New Testament would differ less from the modern, say, the New American Standard than the King James does. He doesn't seem to understand the New American Standard is translated from the Nestle-Aland, and the King James is translated from the TR. So I'm just illustrating the point, and for some reason...
...of the Greek New Testament, using all your own decisions regarding textual variants, that it would differ less from the Nestle-Aland UBS platform than the Textus Receptus does. Would you agree?
Yes.
So you would say, if you included all of your own readings... such as depending on Codex Beze in Mark 1:41 for the reading of anger, would you put that in your text?
Yeah, I would.
Okay, and yet the resultant text would be less different than the King James is from the New American Standard if it was translated?
So there, King James TR, New American Standard, and SCLN UBS platform. Okay, I've just basically repeated my question because I want to make sure people heard that. Because his initial response was just, yes. He didn't expand upon it at all. And what I'm illustrating here is that even with his pet variants, there is less of a difference between his view of what the New Testament should be and what we all deal with almost every Sunday when someone's got a New King James and I've got the New American Standard. Okay, we somehow get along, and what I'm illustrating here is that those atheists who take Ehrman's position and radicalize it are themselves missing the point.
I'm sorry, you lost me there because I thought we were talking about Greek.
Well, yes, but I'm trying to give an illustration to people in the audience. The King James is translated from the TR. The New American Standard is translated from the NA 27, or actually NA 25, I think the last one was 26. But the point is that the differences in readings would be less than you have if you're sitting there with a King James versus the New American Standard. Would that be correct?
I don't know. I've never actually thought about it. I mean, it seems to me it would make a big difference whether you want to say Jesus got angry at a leper or whether he loved him. I mean, it seems pretty significant.
He just didn't get it at that point. Didn't follow the question. Not really sure why that is. Well, anyways, so I actually expected to get through this a little bit farther, but we will continue with that on the next program. And then jump back into the presentation, and it might take a while. But you know what? It's okay. Someone's got to address this stuff, and I appreciate our audience that is willing to. It takes work to work through these things, but we need folks who can give a meaningful answer, because it is this man's books that are being used in the universities and in the schools, and there are just so many people who just take whatever he has to say at face value. They never, ever critically examine it. And we need more and more Christians who are able to demonstrate. Yeah, to see it, Ralph just said, Ehrman just didn't get the vibe of your argument. Yeah, hopefully my argument was a little bit, had a little bit more vibe to it. Than certain legal arguments that were made down in Australia.
Well, he doesn't get the vibe of it because I think he's dreaming.
Yeah, he was dreaming of getting out of there with his honorarium and everything else. Yeah, he certainly was. By the way, Mr. Proby, only I do accents on the dividing line. Okay, just so you know, I am the trained professional, and you are not. So. All right, let's continue on. Let's shift gears, and it is a shifting of gears to move from dealing with Bart Ehrman to dealing with Dia Muhammad. But especially when it comes, hey, Bart Ehrman is almost always right on his factual statements. It's the application that's the problem. You just got smacked in channel by okay. You'll notice that that Mr. Rich doesn't do accents. Well, actually, I think he did once in that one time when he made that one statement that got both of us into a whole lot of trouble. But I think he's learned his lesson, so he's not here to to do that. Anyway, we go back to the debate between Samuel Green and Dia Muhammad, and the last. Don't tell him I said so, but I'm praying Dr. Oakley doesn't do an accent. That's LaShawn. We can't get her into channel, but she's hoping I don't do an accent. And we're just about to play Samuel Green, and he's from Tasmania, talk about an accent. It'll be difficult for me to withhold my tremendous skill and ability. Now people are calling in, don't let him do it! my skill, which was, yes, my skill, which was Turkish, but made in Sweden. Another little funny application there. Sorry, let's get serious now. Okay, remember the last time we were listening, Mr. Muhammad had told us that John 5:7 is the one place where the Trinity appears in the Bible, and it's been taken out. Of course, what he meant was, or what he should mean, is 1 John chapter 5, verse 7, not John 5, 7. They're two different books. But that's the assertion being made. Let's continue as we listen to Dia Muhammad in his opening comments in the debate on the deity of Christ with Samuel Green.
It is the only place in the Bible where they mention the Trinity, where it says, for the three that bear record in heaven, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, and these three are one. In a collection of books that has a Bible, John 5:7 is the only place where the Trinity is mentioned.
Now, again, where the Trinity is mentioned, I didn't see the word Trinity there. There are all sorts of places in the Bible where there is only one true God. There are all sorts of places in the Bible that identify the divine persons doing things that only God can do. There are all sorts of places in the Bible where the three are mentioned together. You think of the conclusion to Paul's letter to the Corinthians, where he uses the Trinitarian formula in the sense of the benediction that is found there. There's all sorts of places like that. And it's just obvious that Mr. Muhammad has not read any Christian books on the Trinity to know the range of evidence that is there. So he's going on secondary sources. He's going on what other Muslims have told him. And as a result, he's just wrong, just way out of phase with reality. And as a result, thinks, and if I thought this, then I would probably argue it as well, but thinks that there's this one place, and it's because of 1 John 5:7, that's the only reason anyone ever believed in the Trinity. And so since it's been taken out, which, you know, how do you take something out? Does he mean that, well, in the NIV, the NIV Translation Committee uses the Greek text that does not contain the Kama Yohannim? Well, all modern Greek texts don't contain the Kama Yohannim. And in fact, the first two editions of Erasmus's text did not contain the Kama Yohannim. But the idea of, well, taken out, and he's going to say it was taken out and put back in here eventually, it just simply is not a valid argument at all.
The whole foundation of Christianity is based in one verse in the whole Bible.
The whole foundation of Christianity is based in one verse. You know, that would be as silly as my pointing to a textual variant, some of the textual variants I've pointed to, and in Surah 2, 222, or places like that, and saying, the whole foundation of Islam is in one verse in the Quran. Really? Honestly? Does that show much of an in-depth understanding of Islam? That's one verse. That's it. Everything else. I mean, is the third ayah of Surah Al-Ikhlas the foundation of Islam? Because I think very clearly the author who wrote Surah Al-Ikhlas did not understand the doctrine of the Trinity. So can I say that all of Islam is a result, is false? I mean, that kind of statement just is not appropriate if you're seeking the truth.
Now, the brother Samuel made a claim that no serious changes have been made in the Bible. I say that's not true. We're here to talk about Jesus, not scripture, but I say that's not true. I believe the brother Samuel uses the New International Version, if I'm not mistaken. Yep, in the NIV. And from memory, I didn't bring it in my Bibles, believe it or not. Finally, in the brief,
he showed up at the debate without a Bible. That might explain some of the citations we end up with.
Preface of the New International Version, referring to the King James Version, which is the most popular version, it says the King James has defects, which are so many and so serious as to call for revision.
Now, he's getting this pretty much straight out of Ahmed Didat and Zakir Naik and all the rest of these folks. But he doesn't seem to understand. If you encountered Mr. Muhammad, and I would like to think you would listen to this. I've written to him. I'm going to write to him again, I guess. But if you encountered, sir, a new translation of the Quran, let's just use some that are actually out there. Let's say that the authors of the Sahih International, which is one of the better translations of the Quran, the Sahih International, in the preface, said that there were manifest difficulties and problems with Yusuf Ali's translation. And they felt the need to provide a better rendering. Would that mean that the Quran has been changed? No. It would mean that there is differences between two English translations. But the Quran was written in Arabic. So obviously, Mr. Muhammad, does it not strike you that the issue would be the Greek and Hebrew texts of the Bible, not the difference between the NIV and the King James Version? Now, there are differences. There are important differences. They go back to the Greek textual tradition. They go back to the Textus Receptus and the modern texts. But we are all well aware of those things and discuss those things very regularly. So he's thinking that the NIV, if it does not evidently contain every word of the King James, is somehow changing the Bible rather than translating a particular Greek or Hebrew text. I can understand why someone would be confused about these things, I guess. But I just don't expect people that are confused about these things to be standing up in public and making comments about them. But then again, all I've got to do is look at the political world and realize I have very high standards that I really shouldn't have and don't match up with reality.
That's what the New International Version says about the King James Version. And I'm happy to be corrected. Getting back to the identity of Jesus, what does Jesus himself say?
He did say he's willing to be corrected. So I would imagine that he should very much enjoy this series of programs where we provide the correction. He says, I'm very willing to be corrected. I hope that he will take it in the spirit intended, and the next time we hear him addressing these things, he won't be saying about how the Trinity was taken out of the Bible, because it wasn't.
Our prophet Jesus, your Lord Jesus. Because remember, we know Jesus doesn't lie. Man of God. No matter what you believe about it, we know he doesn't lie. So let's listen to what he says. He says, truly, truly, I say unto you, the one who is sent is not greater than the one who sent him. So if God Almighty has sent Jesus to us, or has become, in a form of man, he's still sent by God. That's the theology of Christianity.
So is the argument that we are making Jesus greater than God? We've never said that he's greater than the Father. He has taken a position voluntarily of submission to the Father, but it was a voluntary act on his part. That's why we emphasize that so strongly in Philippians chapter 2. And the reflexive pronoun that is found there, well, we emphasized that a week ago when we went through that, well, actually about 2 weeks ago now, we went through that particular text. But he voluntarily did this, so what's the relevance of the text again? Why say, well, the one sent is not greater than the one who sent him? We're not saying he's greater. But notice the assumption, repeated assumption, of Unitarianism, and therefore, and remember at the beginning he said that Jesus was the Father, the Word, and the Spirit, or something along those lines. So it does not seem that he has any even semi-accurate grasp of what it is Christians actually believe on this subject, though he is willing to say that we are wrong about what we believe on this subject.
But he, Jesus, says the one who was sent is not greater than the one who has sent him. Again, listen to what he's saying. He's saying his Father is greater than him. His Father is greater than all. The one who was sent is not greater than the one who sent him. Now, again, the brother Samuel, he said that Jesus died for our sins, that we're forgiven. You know, it's truly a nice thought to say, my actions in this world, I can do whatever I want because my sins are forgiven. That we're not.
Is that really, sir, what you think we believe? May I suggest you you read maybe you know, and one of the problems is here that he has imbibed so much bad information, so much bias, so much literally bigotry against the initial followers of Jesus. He's going to talk about Paul a little bit later on. He's going to keep making Paul the author of Hebrews, but he's going to talk about Paul later on, and he clearly has imbibed a deeply anti-Pauline perspective. Most Muslims have, and it's sad. The early Muslims didn't have that. You can prove the early Muslims did not have that. But may I suggest, sir, that if you're going to criticize Christianity and you're going to make statements about Christianity, it might be a good idea if you actually read the entirety of the New Testament, so that you would know that Christians don't believe you can just go and do whatever you want. Jesus said, if you love me, keep my commandments. And in fact, the objection that you brought up was an objection Paul himself brought up and responded to when he quoted other people in Romans chapter 6 saying, what shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin that grace might increase? May it never be. Megenoita. God forbid, rather non-literally translated by the King James Version. May it never be. So your representation of what we believe was something that one of our apostles at the very beginning presented as an objection and refuted. So doesn't it follow then that you're misrepresenting Christianity if you repeat those same errors? I think it's important to be accurate and truthful. You know, isn't one of the 99 beautiful names Al-Haq, the truth?
We're not accountable for our actions because Jesus has died on the cross. Accept his blood and you're forgiven. Salvation is yours.
We are not accountable for our actions. You mean because our sins, which we are accountable for, are imputed to Christ and borne by another? That means there's no accountability for actions? Not at all. And if you're going to argue that, God would never hold somebody else accountable, then why do the Hadith have all those stories about Moses and Adam talking with one another? I mean, it's a Sahih Hadith where Moses and Adam are speaking to one another, and Moses, in talking about Adam, talks about how it was because of his actions that sin entered into the world. And, of course, then there's also those Hadith in Sahih al-Muslim where, allegedly, anyways, Muhammad says that on the day of judgment, a Jew or a Christian will be brought forth and put in the place of each person that said, La ilaha illallah, so they might enter into paradise. So a Jew or a Christian bears the punishment for the Muslim. That sounds like something that you'd have to object to if you're consistent with your position.
But the Bible tells me something different, completely different. The Bible says, in Ezekiel 18:20, it says, the soul that sinneth, it shall die. In another translation.
Do you think that Dia Muhammad actually looked this up and read Ezekiel 18 and did some background study on the proverb that the people were using about the grape setting the children's teeth on edge? And you think that he really seriously studied what was going on there so that he would understand the background of that text and what God is doing there? I don't get that feeling. I get the feeling that he read some internet articles and listened to Ahmed Didad and Zakir Naik and he's cobbled all this stuff together. And I just don't get the feeling that he's really dealt with Ezekiel 18 in a proper fashion.
And so the soul who sins is the one who will die. The son will not bear the iniquity of the father, nor will the father bear the iniquity of the son. He who commits good deeds, he who does righteous of the righteous will be credited to him. And who commits wickedness of the wicked will be charged against him. So this is clearly saying it's every man on your own. No one can...
Every man on your own. That's the message of the Bible, because I read something about Ezekiel. Let's not worry about all the chapters that talk about the purpose of God and the atonement and imputation and justification. But no. I went back to an Old Testament text, and my interpretation of it is this. So all the rest of that stuff, you just don't even have to worry about it. Now, you know, the Muslim might say, yeah, but you know, we hear people who do that with the Quran all the time. Well, and I criticize those people that do it with the Quran. So I'm consistent. And one of the reasons that writing this book has been so slow for me is that I'm trying to avoid doing exactly that. I don't want to do that. I need to be consistent. But that means I can criticize you when you do that.
If you sin in this world, you're held accountable. If you do good, you'll be credited as such. Completely goes against the notion that one man can bear the sins of mankind. Because
certainly, from a Muslim perspective, he's being consistent with the concept of the scales. You know, you're going to have your good deeds, you're going to have your bad deeds. And, you know, there is the hadith that tells the story about the man who came before Allah in judgment, and he really didn't have any good deeds at all. And he knew he had many, many, many sins. And he just figured he was toast. But a single piece of paper was brought forth with his one good deed. And that was, he said, the Shahada. And so that was put on the scales, and it outweighed all his bad deeds. Well, that sounds pretty nice. Unfortunately, it's mixed together with all of those other places where the person actually does just end up going into hellfire because he doesn't have enough good deeds. And now, remember, there's a big argument, big debate. The evidence seems pretty strong what the earlier perspective was, but there's a big argument and big debate about whether all Muslims go into hell or not. It's the stronger evidence is that they all do. And then they're brought out in groups through the intercession of Muhammad. Until the last ones are called the people of the fire. Because the only thing that has not been blackened on them are the marks of prostration. But they said, la ilaha illallah. So they get to, if they have iman, if they have faith of even an atom, they're the last ones to come out. There's this thing, the sarat, the bridge. And some people go over it quickly, and some people go over it slowly. And it's not, you cannot come up with a consistent interpretation of all the Muslim sources, because they're self-contradictory. But you sort of have to look at probabilities and majority views and stuff like that. And it is a very interesting study.
We're still sinning. From the day Jesus was God, we're still, as humans, we're still sinning. So it doesn't give us any incentive to do good walking on this earth if we know that our account, our debt has been paid for.
Catch that? Doesn't give us any incentive to do good if our account's been paid for. Now here is a man, and here, Mr. Muhammad, I hope that in my correcting of your ignorance of the background of the Bible and the translations of the Bible and stuff like that, that you will not miss this vitally important aspect of things. You don't know what Christians believe, and maybe it hasn't been explained to you very well by some of the people you've talked to. I don't know. But I can tell you, sir, that if you would read the New Testament, you would discover that we do what we do because we've been changed inside. Our hearts have been changed. That same book of Ezekiel, if you keep reading it, talks about how God takes out the heart of stone and gives a heart of flesh. And he sprinkles us with clean water and he makes us new. It's called regeneration, being made a new creature. And a new creature, Mr. Muhammad, does what he does not to try to get brownie points with God, not to try to rack up some kind of an account with God. So we hope that the scales will tip our direction. Because, Mr. Muhammad, if it's a matter of scales, The standard's perfection. The standard's perfection. I mean, God is holy. Nothing unclean can enter into his presence. And so I have to have a perfect righteousness. I can't have a good enough. I need to have a perfect righteousness. And the only place I can find that, Mr. Muhammad, is in my Lord Jesus Christ. Because, you see, he lived a perfect life. And your sources admit that. Remember, Mr. Muhammad, that famous hadith about all the world coming to Adam on the Day of Judgment, asking him to intercede. And he says, I sinned, go to Moses and Abraham. And they eventually get to Jesus. And every person before said, I'm not worthy. I'm afraid. I've never seen my Lord so angry as he is today because I did this. Remember, Moses slew the Egyptian or something like that. They all talked about their sin. But when they came to Jesus, while he then directs them off to Muhammad, it's not because he says he sinned. No accusation is made of sin against Jesus, even in your own sources at that point. But you see, the New Testament teaches that he lived a perfect life. He obeyed the Father perfectly. He fulfilled all of the Father's commands. So that when my sin is imputed to him, his righteousness is imputed to me. That's called the Great Exchange. It's expressed in the Bible in the beautiful words, he made him who knew no sin to be sin on our behalf, that we might become the righteousness of God in him. That's not a matter of, well, I get my ticket punched so I can do whatever I want. That's a matter of recognizing that the only way into the presence of the Father, the only way into the presence of the Holy God, is to have a perfect righteousness. Where am I going to get that? Where are you, Dia Muhammad, going to get that? I say to you, the only way to get it is to find it in Jesus Christ. That's the only way that God has provided for salvation, is by faith in his name. So we don't do what we do to puff up our account. We do what we do because we've been changed. We do it out of love, not out of debt. Not seeking to gain something from God. But because the regenerated heart desires to do what is pleasing to the one who gave us life.
Jesus never said that either in the Bible. Nowhere does he say, I will take your sins on and carry it on my back. Never.
Well, in those words, no, because that's not even really a proper appropriate metaphor, take them on my back type of a thing. But Jesus said it was absolutely necessary that he go to Jerusalem and that he be betrayed in the hands of men and that he be beaten and scourged and put to death and buried and rise again the third day. And he described that in the context of giving his life as a ransom for many. Now, what does that mean, Mr. Muhammad? Could Muhammad have spoken like that? The prophet Muhammad, your prophet, could he have said, I give my life as a ransom for many? No. In fact, he didn't die a very good death. There are a number of hadith that say that that quote Muhammad expressing his desire to die in jihad. He wanted to die in jihad. He didn't die in jihad. How did he die? He died from the poison given to him by a Jewish one. And I got to admit, when you think about it, he ate the food this Jewish woman brought him, and he and the Muslims, not Muhammad personally, but Muhammad as representative of the Muslims, had killed her husband, father, and brother, as I recall. I'm not going to eat her food. If she works at McDonald's, I'm not going through the drive-thru. You know what I mean? And yet she poisoned his food. And he told Aisha, as I recall, that his death was directly related to the poisoning that he had received from that woman. That's not a really good way to die. I think that causes some Muslims a problem, you know, the great and last final prophet, and he's killed by a Jewish woman. Sort of odd, but anyway, could he have, he could not have said what Jesus said. That he gives his life a ransom for many. Jesus laid down his life. He himself in John says, no one takes my life from me. I give it of my own accord. I have the authority to lay it down, and I have the authority to take it up again. Well, why would he lay down his life? Except as a sacrifice. And then when he establishes the Lord's Supper, Mr. Muhammad, he talks about, this is my flesh given for you. This is my blood given for you. How much clearer does it need to be?
So we look through, you know, Brother Samuel made various comments, references to the previous scriptures, saying that we don't believe in the previous scriptures, or we do believe, but we believe it's been corrupted, it's been changed. It has. These are not my words. I'm using the words of the highest scholars of the highest eminence of Christianity.
Oh, so the NIV Translation Committee has now been made the highest and authority in Christianity.
For example, John 5:7. I'll go back to John 5:7.
1 John 5:7. Kama Yohania.
Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. That verse was taken.
Actually, it's the Father, the Word, and the Holy Spirit. There's actually a textual variant there. I discussed this past weekend in St. Louis. Really had a good time there in St. Louis. But my presentations now get to include not only the picture of me in the reading room in Trinity College in Dublin with Codex Monfortianus, which was the codex which forced Erasmus to insert the comma into the third edition of his Greek New Testament, which is why it's in the King James Version today. But within weeks of my having been there in Dublin, they released Codex Monfortianus in PDF. And so I can show you exactly, and I've seen it with my own two eyes. I transcribed it on my droid. So I can absolutely verify the reading of Codex Monfortianus. And there is a variant as far as the when Erasmus put it into the third edition, he put articles in front of each of those words. So he's not even quoting 1 John 5:7 right. He's quoting John 5:7, wrong reference, and he's not even quoting it correctly. I just asked Mr. Muhammad, how impressed would you be if someone was making this argument in regards to the Quran? And they consistently gave the wrong surah and then didn't quote it right. I mean, seriously, how much evidence, how much weight would you place in their statement?
Taking out of the Bible and left out, I think it was about 16 years. I might be corrected. It was left out for a long time. And I challenge all of you to go.
It was left out for a long time? What? 16 years? What? What's he talking about? I have no idea what he's talking about. Because he's later going to say it was because of Bible thumpers it was put back in. I mean, the NIV has never contained it, and it's just an English translation, so that's irrelevant. And there was no Greek text. There was no Greek manuscript of the New Testament, Mr. Muhammad, that contained it until at the absolute earliest, the 1300s. So, 16 years, no, try over 1,000? anyway.
To go ahead, don't take my word for it. Do your research. John.
Yeah, don't take your word for it. Do your research. Good idea, Mr. Muhammad. Do your research. That's why I've examined the actual manuscript that contained it, that put it into what's known as the Textus Receptus today with my own two eyes and my own two hands in the Trinity Library in Dublin, Ireland, February of this year. And I don't think you've ever done that.
John chapter 5, verse 7 was taken out of the Bible as a fabrication.
Fabrication. Yes, a fabrication that was never there in the first place, as people have known for a long, long time. Remember, Mr. Muhammad, look at Erasmus's annotations. Written, this would have been in the middle, third decade of the 16th century. So you're talking almost 500 years ago, and he will tell you why he feels that it is not supposed to be there. This is nothing new. This is really old and not understood.
Your whole call, your whole belief, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, the only place that was mentioned, 5:7, John 5:7, was taken out of the Bible.
Yeah, the only place. I mean, I don't know how I wrote that 200. How many pages is this? Let's not look at the notes. It's only 196 pages. Now, of course, the notes are the majority of the book, so 220 pages. I don't know how I wrote a 220-page book on the Trinity, and it was the only thing I had to work with was 1 John 5:7. And I don't think 1 John 5:7 is original. So what did I... This is blank page after blank page. It's amazing.
Then when the Christians realized, and the Bible thumpers realized, and the priests realized they couldn't push...
Wait a minute. Why hasn't the music started? Because you... What? Did Vicky Ann slip you something? Did she bribe you? I'm sitting here. We're going into the... We're going past... We've gone past the jumbo time. And I'm wondering, was it Ralph or Vicky Ann that bought you off? That's what I want to know.
If they bought me off, they owe me checks. You're on a roll, so I'm just waiting for the music, man.
I'm just waiting for the... You got to keep turning the microphone down because my stomach's grumbling so much. It's lunchtime. That's the problem. So,
well, wrap it up and I'll start playing.
Well,
the
music. Let's start the music, brother, and we'll pick up right where we are next time on the program as we continue our response to Bart Ehrman and Dia Muhammad, and who knows if William Lane Craig comes up with another. I think actually today he posted something I saw on my RSS feeds, and I didn't comment on it today. Oh, that was his interesting theistic evolutionary thing about how animals don't actually know they're in pain type thing. That was interesting. But who knows? He may come up with something that is worthwhile commenting on. We'll see. We'll see you one way or the other on Thursday here on the Dividing Line. See you then. God bless.
Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again this Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. for The Dividing Line.